Today, Paul will give us overview pertaining to telehealth, telemedicine, and mental health. Paul. I also want to thank Paul and the firm for the takeaway gifts that are outside that door. Make sure you take them away.
Okay. Martin, thank you for that nice introduction. I'd like to thank Medical Liability Mutual Insurance Company in inviting me today to talk about telemedicine and telehealth and all those related issues. I understand I'm the last speaker before lunch, so I will try to keep my presentation focused, cogent, and topical. I think we had asked everyone to, hold off questions until the end of the presentation, and I will try to answer questions then. I'm also available later on after lunch if anyone wants to buttonhole me. Telemedicine and telehealth. With advances in technology and the ubiquitous nature of the internet, telemedicine has become more and more of a focus of changes in the delivery of healthcare. It has been, as I've discussed with others, that it's been a feature of healthcare and medical care for decades, but with advances in technology, increases in broadband, et cetera, the delivery of healthcare remotely where a patient is located in one location while a physician is located potentially hundreds of miles away has become more and more of a focus, et cetera. Moreover, with the Affordable Care Act, telemedicine is viewed specifically as a lower barrier to provider access, and as a number of payers will attribute, viewed as an ability to lower healthcare costs in the United States. Today's presentation, I will try to give an overview of telehealth, telemedicine, and mHealth in light of significant federal and state regulatory issues, laws, rules, and regulations. Focus on those points. What you see up here is not a mistake. It's not a handout from one of my daughter's nursery school books, but it's there to make a point. And the Lewis Carroll quote really does have an issue with respect to telemedicine, because in some respects, telemedicine has sort of a looking glass aspect to it. The quote sort of emphasizes something means what it means based upon context and specifically its regulatory underlying. To emphasize that point, I'd like to go through specifically how telemedicine is defined in both federal and state law. CMS Medicare regulations are pretty clear. They don't use the term telemedicine at all. 42 CFR 1395 states that Secretary HHS shall pay for quote-unquote telehealth services, not telemedicine, to the extent that they are furnished via telecommunication systems. That term, telecommunications, is critical to understanding how telehealth is defined under federal law. Based upon the definition of interactive telecommunication systems at 42 CFR 410, that defines telehealth as the use of interactive multimedia audiovisual equipment allowing critically, two-way real-time interactive communication. The patient and the physician have to not only see each other, they have to communicate with each other, typically via an audio communication. Under the regulations, emphasize is telephones, facsimile machines, and email are specifically excluded from the definition of telehealth. That phone consult with your patient is not covered under Medicare fee-for-service. Moving now to New York State, there has been, as recently as last year, amendments to the public health law, which go into specific definitions of what both telehealth and telemedicine are. Telehealth, as defined in its 299.9 of the public health law, talks about the use of, quote unquote, electronic information and communication technology for delivery of healthcare services, for diagnosis, consultation, treatment, education. You see again the exclusion of phone, facsimile, that sort of dates sort of the communications, and email from the definition of telehealth. However, those media can be used in the overall use of telehealth provision of services. The public health law then goes on to define telemedicine. Now we see this term used specifically with the similar CMS definition. Synchronous two-way electronic audiovisual communication. Again, patient has to be seen and heard with the provider, et cetera. Has anyone noticed something about this definition? Telemedicine? It's the same one as telehealth in the federal law. So if you're talking about CMS, you use the term telehealth. In New York State law, it's telemedicine. Clear as mud, right? Generally, telehealth is, in the vernacular, the more general term, more all-encompassing, and includes not only synchronous, but also technologies such as store and forward, as well as remote patient technology, monitoring. Store and forward is, as many of you know, is the downloading of images, and it's in synchronous transmission. It's typically used in teleradiology, things that lend itself for downloading of an image and then sent to the physician or the provider to review and provide notes. Remote patient monitoring. Again, you have the patient in one location and the provider, the advanced nurse practitioner monitoring the patient via electronic media and allows the data to be transmitted from the patient to the physician extender to allow for monitoring, et cetera. Finally, we talk about mHealth, which is an acronym for basically medical devices that are used mobily. MDDSs, or also known as MDDSs, are intended to provide for one or more of the following. Electronic transfer of medical device data, storage of medical device data, conversion of that data from one format to another, and finally, the display. Sorry. Ultimately, telehealth is not a distinct form of medicine, but merely the practice of medicine by a different modality. Safe telemedicine is safe medicine. It is, to that extent, as we'll talk about in more detail, held to the same standard of care as if a provision of care was done in person. I'd like to now go through point by point a number of the issues that arise with respect to telemedicine. Licensure. I can attest, I've talked to counsel, attorneys admitted in New York, and they take the position that a provider only needs to be licensed in wherever they are located. To the extent they are providing care to a patient in New York, Connecticut, wherever, that provider doesn't have to be licensed in that state. Unfortunately, that is critically wrong. The Attorney General's Office in 2000 issued a statement that to the extent that someone is providing medicine via telemedicine to a patient in New York, that is deemed to be the practice of medicine, and if they are not licensed, it is viewed as the illegal practice of medicine. That's a pretty critical issue, and I can see, as a practical matter, this comes up a number of instances where, you know, thinking about this, the snowbird situation where the patient is here in New York for 6 months out of the year and then goes to Florida. To what extent does that provider in continuing care to the patient who lives in Florida for 6 months and uses a video, audiovisual communication and tries to get reimbursed for that, that provider technically needs to be licensed in the state of Florida to the extent that patient is located in Florida at the time. Licensure requirements, a number of companies, including my former company, where I was general counsel, telemedicine by itself, because you no longer have this limitation on barrier on distance, you know, a provider can be wherever, creates challenges if there's a provision for multi-state operations. A provider ultimately could provide care in a number of states. However, they would need to be licensed in every state where they're providing care to that patient. Attempts at the federal level in Congress, there was a proposed bill in the 2015 Congress, Telemed Act, which would have allowed, to the extent one doctor was licensed in one state, to be licensed in multiple other states, did not succeed. There have been attempts to lower barriers, specifically through the Federation of State Medical Boards, where in 2014 they adopted the Interstate Medical Licensure Compact. That compact basically is a treaty among adopting states that allows, to the extent that the state adopted the compact, a provider licensed in that state can then become licensed in multiple other states, basically any other state that adopts the compact, only to the extent they file a one-page application for licensure. It still requires the doctor, the physician, to be licensed based state by state, but much lower barrier in filing for applications. To date, we have 17 states have adopted the compact. However, it's not anticipated New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, Massachusetts will adopt the compact anytime soon. Patient-physician relationship. A critical aspect of the doctor-patient relationship is the establishment of that relationship. This is driven to a great deal by state law, and the question arises is, what is required in order to establish a patient-physician relationship via telemedicine? Separate and apart from that, there are certain other points I'd like to raise about the telemedicine encounter that's critical. Whatever is used, that the name of the physician needs to be accessible to the patient as well as their license number in order to allow for complaint process and potential medical liability issues. There were instances of telemed providers operating nationally where you didn't know the name of the doctor on the other end, who this doctor was, and created some issues. The doctor also, at a minimum, has to require that, you know, they identify through verification, typically date of birth, that the patient they're talking to is actually who they are. Some states, in order to establish a patient-physician relationship, such as Texas, do not allow the establishment of the patient-physician relationship via telemedicine, but rather requires an initial in-person physical examination. This is very much a case of state law, and it varies state by state. Here in New York, we are one of the more progressive states on this issue, and by case law, we can establish a patient-physician relationship through a telemedicine encounter. Finally, again, the Federation of State Medical Boards, they tend to be the most active issue on entity in this, because state boards are always looking for it for guidance, and the view is to try to develop national standards. The FSMB promulgated in 2014 its model policy on the use of telemedicine technologies. In that model policy, they acknowledge that one could establish a patient-physician relationship through the use of telemedicine. Just to emphasize the point, it is a model policy. It is not law in any state unless adopted. Certain states have adopted it. North Carolina was one that comes to mind. But you really work with counsel to ensure that, to the extent telemedicine is being used in a state, that those requirements of that state's medical board are satisfied in order to establish the patient-physician relationship. Standard of care. Standard of care is an issue related to patient-physician relationships, but it's somewhat different. It is, as I said previously, standard of care for a telemedicine encounter will be held to the same standard of care that that consult, if done in person, is held to. That creates a challenge. That creates a big challenge. Because of the modality and what's available to the physician, what can be treated safely is going to be limited. If we're talking about a telemedicine encounter that focuses solely on the use of a visual, where there are no other vitals involved, that's going to be very limited in what can be treated safely. There's finally the issue of what the applicable standard of care is, because of the fact that standard of care may vary by community, and to what extent does the standard of care of the provider control. The American Telemedicine Association, of which I'm a member, has developed some standards in order to apply to the use of telemedicine. Prescribing. So we have instances where sometimes a physician wants to prescribe to a patient via telemedicine encounter. As always, whether or not a prescription is issued is going to be a function of medical necessity, whether it's medically necessary for the treatment of the condition. And that's what New York law will determine, whether or not it's appropriate for the physician to write a script. Federal law, though, has a lot of impact on this as well. The Ryan Haight Act, online pharmacy, enacted by Congress in 2008, goes to the issue of what was intended to shut down internet pharmacies. Ryan Haight was a California resident. He was a teenager. Goes on to the internet, looks for meds, looks for controlled substances, looks for OxyContin or whatever. There is a Marshall Island physician on the other end of the phone, gets his script, goes and fills it, and dies of an overdose. Outrage, Barbara Boxer out of California, the senator out of California, leads the charge for that. It was in her constituency. The Ryan Haight Act, by definition, makes it explicit that to the extent someone has not examined that patient in person initially, except in very limited circumstances, that is a per se violation of the Controlled Substance Act. Provisions are made for violations, or it could be loss of your DEA registration, but prescribing a controlled substance via the internet, via telemedicine, unless it's done within the prescription provided for, is a serious violation. Reimbursement. Everyone wants to get paid for telemedicine, right? That's what it's all about. But the laws and rules on reimbursement are very complicated and are not apparent. Medicare fee-for-service, you know, the telehealth definition, doesn't reimburse for telehealth encounters unless you meet very specific restrictions, specifically provision of services in rural health professional shortage areas or outside of a metropolitan statistical area. New York State insurance law did not require reimbursement for telemedicine until 2016. However, the quote-unquote telemedicine parity law was adopted and came into effect in 2016. In that instance, it joined up 27 other states and reimbursed for telemedicine counters for telehealth providers. A couple points about this. One, again, it is the definition of telemedicine. It's the audiovisual encounter. It is not a phone consultation. It is not an email chat. It is none of those. It is only via a audiovisual communication that the provider can be reimbursed. It is an insurance law mandate. So to a great extent, self-insured groups are excluded. And a number of payers will take the position that if a patient presents themselves and is not and is covered under a self-insured plan, they will not be, that encounter will not be paid unless the ERISA plan, the self-insured plan, allows for it. And some do. It all varies state by state, but by plan by plan. What's very good about the law here in New York State, the parity law, is who's an eligible provider. It's not just physicians, it's dentists, nurse practitioners, psychologists, social workers, PAs, nurses, which allows for a very broad basis for reimbursement. One other point about the reimbursement that has come up is the fact of how is that encounter paid? And unfortunately, the payers have taken the position that to the extent that that encounter is covered, they will reimburse at what they view as their reimbursable expense, their cost for that encounter, i.e., it is not the rate that would have been paid if that patient was seen in person. There is a bill pending in Albany to try to change that. The payers are very much against it, but one of the challenges about telemedicine for providers is, what was an $80 reimbursable expense in office has now become a $25 telemedicine reimbursement expense. One other point not in the slide is Medicare Advantage plans. Medicare fee-for-service excludes it, but there are certain Medicare Advantage plans which will reimburse for this. Depends on the carve out, how they provide for it. They may have a preferred telemedicine provider that they'll reimburse for. It varies based upon the payer. HIPAA. Again, because of the nature of telemedicine and the remote nature of the encounter, HIPAA and privacy laws are very important. Aspect of it, because of the nature of the how information is transmitted and also how the EHR stores it. As a covered entity, providers have to ensure that they have BAs with all of their business associates and to ensure that patient PHI is kept to a minimum necessary disclosure. The discussion or the point about this is that to the extent an EHR or the encounter uses an EHR that's stored in the cloud, you have to ensure that that cloud provider is HIPAA compliant. So Google Drives uses a HIPAA compliant format. It is secure and encrypted. iCloud, a number of others are not. So it's very critical to determine whether or not that meets the requirements of HIPAA. There's also the issue of the actual encounter, how that is done. Video via Skype although not specifically required by HIPAA, is not a secure medium. And to that extent, as an attorney, as a partner, I would not recommend that a provider use Skype in order to do a consultation. It doesn't lend itself to a secure transmission. Use of firewalls, encrypted transmission, is highly recommended and called for. Malpractice, what we're all here about, right? Physician held to the standard of care as if the encounter was done in person. However, with respect to whether there's coverage available, in discussing this, I've been informed that you really should check with Milnick on these issues, on these questions. And we can talk further about this during the Q&A. My experience as to what extent there is a number of malpractice cases involving telemedicine, there are few reported cases in this. It's due to the novelty of the formality and the modality. Obviously, that will change over time. But at this juncture, there hasn't been much litigation for malpractice with respect to telemedicine encounters. That may be the factor of the standard of care. The national providers who do this, the American Wells, the Teladocs, don't do much other than treat for minor medical conditions, upper respiratory conditions that don't lend itself to malpractice claims. Credentialing, another key aspect for hospital systems and outpatient facilities. Where does the provider get credentialed? Going back to the licensure issue, you can take the position, well, he or she is credentialed at the facility where they're located, not where the patient is. And that's wrong. Joint Commission does not allow that. That provider needs to be credentialed at the facility where the patient is located. The Joint Commission has developed certain alternatives that are available to credential that distant site provider, and some of the issues are discussed here. One, they can either go through a full credentialing process at the originating site. They can use that originating site can use information from the distant site to the extent that it's JC accredited. The originating site facility can use the distant site provider, again, Joint Commission accredited, has privilege of the same services, and it's subject to the originating site's internal review process. The originating site hospital must ensure that the hospital's distant site's privileges meet or exceed CMS standards. And that's the quote, that's the citation to the Joint Commission. Psychology and psychiatry. I thought it best to cite to this specific area of practice because of the nature of its practice and certain unique issues that arise in connection with treatment of patients. The Office of Professions that's issued an alert on the use of telepsychiatry and psychology in New York State and provides fairly extensive guidance to providers on what should and should not be done with respect to treating a patient via telemedicine for psychology or psychiatry. The number of the issues raised are issues that we've discussed before: licensure, standard of care, physician-patient establishment of the patient-patient relationship, HIPAA concerns. Moreover, though, there is a focus on additional issues that are unique to the population. And it's incumbent upon the provider to determine, does this patient have potential for self-harm? And is there a basis for local self-support for if there are issues with the patient? Whether telemedicine is actually the proper modality to treat the patient. Not all patients lend themselves well to the use of telemedicine. Being in person, having the psychiatrist or psychologist present may be the better approach for that individual patient and using of that. Moving now more into discussions about mHealth devices. Again, we talked about this previously. mHealth is mobile devices that allow for the transmission of patient data remotely. You know, these are the examples of them. You know, your Fitbits, your RunKeepers. They're ubiquitous. They're found everywhere, but they do basically not much. And it's a question of what these mobile devices really are meant to do. It is potentially, though, that mHealth devices are going to become more significant and evolve into more sophisticated medical devices and come more subject to regulation. With respect to medical devices, mHealth devices, the FDA has the ability to review and approve those devices. February 2015, the FDA comes out with a very seminal guidance on the use of medical device data systems, NDDS. And as we see here, defines, again, the use of these devices. Transfer of medical data, storage, display, conversion, et cetera. The critical element of what an MDS is, according to the FDA, is whether or not is engaged in active patient monitoring. To the extent a device just takes data from one space to another to the provider, the FDA has taken the position that that is not subject to the FDA pre-market notification process. And that's critical. I mean, I've worked with device manufacturers, and whether or not they can have to go through that pre-market notification process will live or die or determine success of that product. It was surprising in that the FDA took a very supportive approach to the use of these devices by not requiring pre-market notification. EHR and meaningful use. Probably most everyone here is familiar with it, so I won't spend much time on it. But the reason why I want to discuss EHRs is that, again, they lend themselves to telemedicine. They're an integral part of it, and allows for the transmission and storage of information in connection with the telemedicine encounter. Not all EHRs meet the requirements of meaningful use under the EHR program for CMS. We're in stage two, and as that, eligible professionals are required to meet a number of objectives. I think there are 10 objectives in stage two meaningful use that providers are subject to. Let's just go through these slides. Okay. Let's now talk about patient monitoring and its use in connection with a part of telehealth, as we talked about before. Some examples of patient monitoring systems that are approved by the FDA. There is growth of the industry, the view that it is critical with respect to, as providers become more at risk for patient care, allows for active monitoring of those patients without being in a facility setting, cost savings, and avoidance of penalties for readmissions. Want to briefly talk about the NIST, the National Institute of Standards and Technology, which is integral for the requirements for EHRs. They are part of the federal government. They develop national standards on EHRs and a number of other things in order to allow that the EHR is the concept of interoperability and the fact that the medical record is a searchable document, et cetera. Again, more discussions about that. The focus here is through the use of the NIST standards, the focus of the SHIN New York, where by use of these EHR records allows for participation in the use of in the SHIN New York, based upon verification of the records. As many of you know, New York is an opt-in state. In order for the patient to have their medical records available in the SHIN network, they have to opt in. Based upon data from the SHIN New York facility website, we're now about 8.6 million have provided consent, which is very good. I looked at, in preparation for this, state adoption, and there seems to be more adoption up here upstate than it is downstate, but movement towards consent, hospital facilities are probably the most entities that have adopted, physician practices less so. The last slide here, the last couple of slides here, talk about antitrust. And the question is, why are we talking about antitrust with respect to telemedicine? And not an issue here in New York, but it's very much an issue elsewhere in the country and involves my own company. And it centers on the use of patient safety rules with respect to telemedicine. As I previously stated, Texas is a state that requires an in-person physician examination in order to establish a patient-physician relationship in order to engage in telemedicine. And those rules are still in place. There are other rules, though, about whether or not you can prescribe remotely outside of telemedicine without touching the patient in person. There were vague rules in Texas. I worked, and when I was general counsel, we litigated this issue and we won, that there was no requirement to touch that patient. And the medical board in Texas went through the process of promulgating new rules, and my successor at Teladoc then sued them under antitrust laws. And the issue here is, which is a somewhat interesting point, is when is a patient safety regulation meant to restrain trade? When is it not meant, although appears to be for purposes of patient safety, to limit competition? And that is a critical aspect of telemedicine. Because of its nature, because of the way it's done, you're removing barriers to entry to come into a state's, to provide medical services in a state. Texas took the position that you have to do it you have to touch that patient to engage in telemedicine. Teladoc sued, and it is currently subject to the medical board subject to an injunction based upon the concept that the medical board promulgated rules that were not based on patient safety, that they were just meant to restrain and prevent competitors to come into the market. I anticipate this case will go up to the Supreme Court. I follow it very closely for my clients, and it deals with a very interesting aspect of rules in general, to what extent patient safety drives some rules. Questions?
We'll take questions again, but we have to wait for the microphone to come up. Joyce, right here.
Hi. You did mention anything about supervision of medical students, residents, fellows, when they're going to visit patients to their homes or, for example, critical care access. They can have somebody next to them as a nurse or social worker, but really not physician. Is it allowed? How are we documenting it? How are we dealing it?
So doesn't that raise issues of to what extent they're under a supervising physician's? They have to be under a supervising physician's.
Can we use telemedicine for this? I know that we have to be next to them, but
right.
If we can see patient through technology, can we supervise?
So I want to be clear at the question. So the nurse extender goes and visits the person in their home and consults with a physician via telemedicine? Or is the...
With my fellow or medical resident, and I'm usually supervising them. But is it okay going with the nurse, documenting everything in our system, and I by some part of their...
Where are you? And
I'm in a hospital, they at home, or in a critical access
And how hospital. Are you communicating with them?
Yes, we have the same EMR. I see sometimes patients there, but particularly I could not see this patient as initial consult. They go together with the nurse in a request of families that do not want to drive to our hospital.
Right. To the extent that the resident is communicating with you, correct?
Yes, I'm supervising.
Yeah, I don't see an issue with that. Now, whether that's a reimbursable visit, that's another issue, but that's permitted as long as the...
From education point, from billing point, you don't know.
Billing point is going to be a function of...
Telemedicine?
Right. Is there an audiovisual? Is there going to be communication back and forth with that?
Yes, and this is arising some...
And is if that was done in a hospital, would that be reimbursed?
If in a hospital, it will be. If I'm physically in a hospital, but my residence somewhere.
No. Let's change the facts. That patient is now in the hospital. Your resident goes see them. Is that reimbursed by the payer?
Yes.
Okay. Then technically, that code can be used with a telemedicine modifier to get reimbursed.
And if I would like to prescribe opioids for this. Patient, he's an end-of-life care, and I would like to start something more
So what medications are we talking about, though?
For example, some opioid drip.
Okay. I'm not a clinician. Are those controlled substances?
Yes.
Okay. You have seen that patient previously, though, in person?
No. Patient in a distant location. It's a one-hour drive. My nurse and resident going to check up.
I believe I would have to verify that. I believe that's permitted under Ryan Hape because of the presence of the nurse extender in person with the patient. That's correct.
Not practitioner, registered nurse.
If there's a registered nurse with that person at their home and you are on the other end via video, that's permitted under Ryan Hape.
Am I allowed to use FaceTime or...
See, those are not secure media. That there's a HIPAA issue. There's concern that that's not going to be that could be hacked. I mean, that's not a secure transmission.
What is your suggestion?
There are options. I'm sorry. Are you associated with one of the hospitals up here?
You're
Orange Regional?
Yeah.
Okay. Right.
We don't have palliative care there, and they have really great need. And we're working on a development some program. But physically, I cannot be there.
Yeah, no, it's a large geographic area. I'm familiar with it. And sure, why don't we talk afterwards, and we can sort of...
Thank you.
Okay.
Are there any other questions? Dr. Bamba?
I just wanted to add a comment on to the AMA CPT codes and what CMS has put out for 2017. I talked about the codes for advanced care planning services. It was out for comment so that telemedicine would be extended to include that. And not the controlled substance issue that you address, but for a lot of what you do, Emma, in terms of conversations and the MULS process that I talked about this morning, that's all covered under that code, and CMS has proposed covering that via telemedicine with all of the security that you've talked about. In fact, we have a New York State licensed palliative care physician trained in the city who resides in California, who's involved in EMULS in a secure way today, but is not reimbursable. Those services, if there's no rejection, that should be then reimbursable next year.
I mean, and for fee for service,
Yeah, this would be under CMS, and so that basically is a rule that's gone into effect. If it goes into effect, and there's nothing that has come back in terms of their request for comments, which closed at the beginning of September, that would go into effect January 1st, 2017.
Right. It's not currently reimbursable, but it's a constantly evolving area. I mean, and CMS has always been concerned that it's not reimbursing for an encounter that it's just driving up costs. So, again, they've become much more accepting of this. Also, risk is being transferred to the providers themselves, and they basically say, you deal with it because it's you're at risk. So, you know, providers are put at, the onus is on the provider to allow for a more cost effective. But, constantly evolving. New York State insurance law, that's also reimbursable. It would be reimbursable, so.
Yep. And I think in terms of the important things having, as we work at a health plan in New York State, you know, everything that you said is absolutely correct. Whatever we can do face-to-face with the caveats of the secure lines and whatnot, we need to reimburse. And we've obviously tested it. Our employees have access within the confines of the law. But what's exciting, I think, is some of the expansion that CMS has done, because if CMS says yes, and the encouragement for other insurers to follow.
Right, and then the private payers tend to follow in line, so.